Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Hallgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Coming up on today's show, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Alejandro Escovedo, and an early review of Ed Burns' new movie, The Groomsman.
Plus, we'll hand out Our Best Fiends, the best of the Herzog-Kinski Marathon Awards, and reveal this week's top five movies we should have hated. But first, there'll be a picture of Captain Jack etched onto his tombstone. Johnny Depp and crew return in Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest.
What is it that has Jack spooked?
How much do you know about Davy Jones?
You owe me your soul. And it's time to pay up.
Like any good sequel, and by good, of course, I mean really expensive, Dead Man's Chest reunites all of the key players from its predecessor, the 2003 breakout hit, The Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl. Back on board are director Gore Verbinski, stars Johnny Depp, Orlando Bloom, and Keira Knightley, and ensemble players Jack Davenport, Jonathan Pryce, and Lee Ehrenberg. Among the notable new additions are Stellan Skarsgård as bootstrap Bill Turner and beloved British character actor Bill Nye as the infamous Grim Reaper of the Sea, Davy Jones, who is after our nefarious but somehow lovable hero, Captain Jack Sparrow, in order to settle up an old debt. Now, Sam, I could ramble on about Nye's fantastic performance, but the real allure of Pirates isn't the new faces, of course. It's the masqueraded black-tooth mug of enigmatic star Johnny Depp. Just one of the many unpopular positions you've taken on this show is your insistence that Depp's Keith Richards by way of Pepe Le Pew portrayal of Captain Jack isn't worthy of all the adulation it has received, including a Best Actor nomination and inclusion on Premiere's recent list of the top 100 performances of all time. In fact, Depp was the single biggest reason you didn't like The Curse of the Black Pearl. Did you find Jack Sparrow any more sufferable this time around?
Yeah, no, I mean, this has come up once or twice, I think, on the show. We've never talked specifically about the first Pirates movie in depth. And I just want to give a bit of background. I mean, I went to see the first Pirates really late in its run, really. I mean, I think this was a big summer blockbuster. I saw it in the fall at a second-run movie house. And of course, my expectations, contrary to just about everyone else's, who I think went into it with low expectations, and I think you'd put yourself in that camp, you know, the fact that it is a Disney movie about a pretty, you know, cheesy ride at Disney World. And so I saw it when everyone had said, oh my God, it's so great, it's so great. And so maybe unfairly went into it. And I think I've talked about it negatively. And the fact is, though, I look back on it, and it wasn't the story so much that I had a problem with. I mean, I was sort of interested in the story. My big problem with it, and it's the big, you know, contrarian point, is the fact that my biggest problem with that film was Johnny Depp's performance. I really want to compare it. I was trying to think of how I could compare it, because I really feel like the first Pirates movie sets up this really brisk, fun tone that I think everyone else, including certainly the director, but certainly the cast members, are involved in. It's light, it's fun. And Johnny Depp, whenever he was on screen, slowed the movie down to a crawl with his performance. And I honestly think it's a pretty selfish performance. And it's almost like this rock band is just rocking out, and all of a sudden, Johnny Depp would come on with his cello and, you know, play a cello solo for 5 minutes while everyone is waiting, and the story waits to pick up momentum again. And so needless to say, I was not thrilled about, you know, seeing the sequel. And I'm really surprised, and I know I am alone here, that I'm really surprised people are so much more excited about this movie than Superman returning after 20 years to screens. I can't believe it, but that seems to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the fact is, you want more Johnny Depp as Captain Jack Sparrow? That's what you're going to get. That's what this movie is. And it sort of, I think, follows the path of you know, of a movie focused on Captain Jack Sparrow. And now the movie, the second movie, and I don't think the first one was, this second movie is just as boring and self-indulgent as Johnny Depp's performance. Now, it remains to be seen if people agree with me, but that's my quick judgment of the movie.
Okay. Well, it's funny because on Saturday, before I saw this movie Saturday night, I went to my first ever NASCAR race, Sam.
We've I'm so glad you brought this up.
A little bit. I went to my first ever NASCAR race. I had some family in town that are into NASCAR. They're NASCAR fans. So I took them out to Joliet, Chicagoland Motor Speedway, and we saw this race. And I had a decent time. I really did. But I realized later that watching this
movie... Just revving up for Ricky Bobby, really.
That's it.
Talladega Nights.
And I did see the trailer
again. Doing some research, yeah.
But watching this movie was a similar experience to
wow.
this NASCAR race. The cars start racing. It's pretty exciting. But then there are periodic pauses because of caution flags.
Sure.
Things ebb and flow a little bit, and they start going again, and you're still into it until about lap 120 of 200 when, you know, you really start to feel like you're just being assaulted. The sound of the engines blasting your eardrums nonstop and just the repetition of it, and it becomes not nearly as exciting anymore. In fact, it becomes a little boring, and this is exactly how I felt about this movie. I was just assaulted by the endless special effects sequences, the attacks at sea, the sword fights. Exactly what you expect from a sequel, that's what this movie is.
Yeah.
Bigger budget, everything is bigger. It has none of the charm. You talked about the lightness and the fun everyone was having in the first film. I didn't get that at all here. All the charm is gone. This is just a big budget visual assault on my senses, and it really became for me, starting out a movie through the first hour or so, a movie that I realized I was already not liking.
Yeah.
But if people ask me about it, I wouldn't say, you know,
yeah,
don't go see it. I would say maybe go ahead. If you think you're really into it, you like the first one, check it out. By the end, it became a movie I would actively dissuade people from spending their time on. That's how much it annoyed me by the end of the film.
Yeah, I really feel the same way. And getting back to Johnny Depp for a second, I don't dislike Johnny Depp. I don't have a natural Johnny Depp bias, although I feel like the last couple times he's come up, I've been negative. Willy Wonka particularly. We didn't care for that choice of his either. But the fact is, he's being all of a sudden asked to carry a 2.5-hour comic film. The first one is more of a caper film. It's a movie about pirates and piratery, piracy. And this movie is just really, it's like 2.5 hours of Johnny Depp being funny. But the fact is, Johnny Depp is not a comedian. You know, this would be one thing if Pirates of the Caribbean was like, you know, Jim Carrey as Captain Jack Sparrow, who has carried films, comic films. But really, he's reduced to mugging. For comic effect. And really, I feel like he's put in a really unfair position. I mean, there's a lot of just, you know, the plot of the movie, or many plots, have these weird sidetracks. Early in the film, I honestly thought I missed something, where we have Johnny Depp as the chieftain of this tribal group. And
right.
I really thought there was a scene cut out, and I just missed the fact, because we see him escaping in, you know, great fashion from a coffin at sea.
Right.
And all of a sudden, he is dressed garishly and speaking, you know, comically in French and gibberish to this group of tribesmen who think he's a god. And it's just like, really, it had no other purpose other than really this sort of cartoonish effect.
Yeah, well, the whole movie, unfortunately, is filled with these convoluted plot devices, plot machinations, where things happen really for no good reason that I can tell. And in fact, I was actually confused by this movie.
I really was.
Most often, I was confused at why people were actually doing what they were doing, what they were trying to get, why they were in certain places.
And there's a scene where one of the secondary characters actually has to explain it to us in the audience. I mean, at least the screenwriters know that they have really gotten so far off track, it's time to update the audience. It's like, okay, by the way, this is what the movie is.
Yeah, and that's something you lose from the first one. Again, it had a very simple story, and yet I really did find it charming. We're going to get into this in our top five movies that surprised us, movies we went in assuming we'd hate. And even though by the time I saw Pirates on DVD, sure, I'd heard all the buzz, but I still expected not to have a very good time. And then I ended up having a similar experience I had when I was in eighth grade watching The Princess Bride. I really felt like The Pirates of the Caribbean was kind of an update on The Princess Bride. You've got this romantic story between Will and Elizabeth. You've got the swashbuckling aspect with Jack Sparrow. The sword fighting scene between Jack and Will just blew me away. I thought it was great fun and simple. Didn't have a lot of special effects in it, was just simple and charming, and it was more about their verbal and physical interplay than anything else, than the big theatrics of it. And then you add in the supernatural aspect. I have to say, when Jeffrey Rush changed, that his face changed at night, and you realize that all of a sudden this movie that had all these elements already is now going supernatural, I remember being really excited by that and thinking, wow, I'm really surprised that a movie's able to integrate all of these different aspects. I thought it did it very well. Like I said, it became kind of a Princess Bride, a perfect date movie.
Yeah.
I can see guys and girls taking their dates, whatever, getting into this film. And this movie just, unfortunately, doesn't have any of that. Any of those things I just said that were so good about the first one, this movie doesn't have. It's a bad sequel. And like I said, it really, really annoyed me. But back to Johnny Depp's performance for a minute. I think he's okay here, just like I thought he was. Well, I thought he was really good in the first one, unlike you.
And used maybe effectively,
people.
I think you'd say.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we talked about recently our top five character actors, actors who make big, bold choices, even if they're on screen for a small amount of time.
Memorable choices.
Memorable choices. He certainly made a memorable choice. You can't argue that. And it did work for me. I mean, I was trying to think the whole time, if someone took a more conventional approach to this pirate, I think it would be kind of boring. And maybe he could slow it down a little bit because the movie was so fast-paced, it was so up-tempo and active that I thought that kind of worked. There were some good dynamics there. Here, there's an interesting contradiction. You mentioned that the movie revolves around him, and it does. He's sort of the side character that gets turned into the main character.
Exactly.
And yet, because the movie is so big and bearing this cumbersome burden of the special effects and having these huge sequences, I feel like he's actually lost in it completely. He's not nearly as interesting in this film, whether it's the lines he's saying or the way he's delivering them, as he is in the first movie. And his character just isn't nearly as interesting. You've got a conflicted Jack Sparrow here, a guy who doesn't know what he wants in life. That sounds just like something you would do with a sequel, taking a great character who's naturally
adding
sort
ambiguity,
of just really flawed, and then you try to make him real somehow.
Well, see, I just didn't understand what's so compelling about the character, the real problem of the character. It's like, he doesn't even seem to be a very good pirate. He's a coward. He's not somebody we can root for necessarily. And he's not just this sort of ragamuffin that's getting in the way of the actual plot. With the plot revolving around him, it really becomes a problem of, like, what is his goal? Why is his crew sticking with him? He seems to be incompetent, scared. I don't know. I mean, he's just a really strange fabrication. And it's like it worked. He worked as a secondary character for those people that it worked with. In the first one, I can recognize that. In this, it really is a mess. But you did mention the special effects, and I want to get to something that I did like about the film.
Okay.
The special effects, particularly, I think, really, the crew of the Flying Dutchman. Davy Jones, you know, his ship that, you know, emerges from the bottom of the sea. Like you said, the Grim Reaper of the sea. And I think not only does Bill Nye give a fantastic performance.
He's amazing.
And he's buried under a special effect makeup. Almost bringing, I don't know if you noticed this, I was trying to think of what he was reminding me of, is the Cowardly Lion almost. He had this wonderful little snarl that is Cowardly Lion-esque.
Facial twitch. Yeah. You're right.
But he really uses it so well. It's like a really big, fun character. And I think really I just wanted to recognize, like, they're throwing a bunch of money. They threw a bunch of money and threw a lot of talented people at just imagining the set decoration of the ship, you know, of the Flying Dutchman. The characters on there are really wonderful to look at, just from a sheer, like, pleasure to look at. I mean, they all are. That's a fantastic creation.
There are some interesting uses of special effects here, but I think you would agree with me that, pardon the pun, they just go overboard with it throughout the movie. I was thinking of a scene where we meet Stellan Skarsgård, who is so covered by makeup, I did realize it was him. I said to you, wow, it was Stellan Skarsgård. Yeah. I thought it was the whole time, but I didn't know for sure until I saw on IMDb. And there's an interesting scene where we meet him, and he's talking to Jack Sparrow, and it could have been a really creepy, effective scene, and I feel like it's something that in the first movie probably would have been handled well. And instead,
something like a Jacob Marley kind of scene.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This kind of ghost visiting you, and it's very, you know, scary, could be. Mm-hmm. And yet, because of the special effects, because of the fact that they make him this grotesque sea creature who's literally oozing stuff and bugs are crawling out of him, and he has to take time out to eat the bug. Just like Verbinski's like, here, we're going to give the audience a whole moment that's going to make them shudder. And those are those kind of just overboard, not really funny, hit you over the head moments where if you had taken
cartoonish,
those things out,
it really becomes a cartoon.
If you'd taken those things out, the scene would have actually worked. Yeah. And the movie's filled with that kind of humor that isn't really funny at all, just kind of hitting you over the head with it.
Yeah, bad staging. Like intentionally, over the top comic staging. And I think the thing is, and I think what this lacks as a story is really some stakes. There was really no danger.
No.
I mean, and I do remember that from the first one. There's a fun level of stakes. You really feel like Orlando Bloom's character is risks losing her. And there's just a sense of, like, just really basic stuff that you think is basic until a movie like this screws it up by being so focused on, you know, these spectacular effects and characters and trying to give everyone something to do.
And being so convoluted that you lose track of the basic storyline,
really,
which is the real problem here. I will single out, though, I did actually like Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley in this film. Again, they aren't given much to do in terms of being interesting, just like Johnny Depp isn't. But we ripped on Orlando Bloom for Elizabethtown, and I think he does have a problem, as we said then, kind of playing normal characters.
Right,
and
they're not epic.
Yeah, and he has a problem in Kingdom of Heaven maybe being asked to carry too much.
Sure.
But in these sword and sandal kind of films or whatever, these pirate
films. He's got amazing grace.
He does.
And,
he's really good. He's got this Errol Flynn-like kind of quality. I know that's blasphemy, but he does, and he's good in these roles, and even Keira Knightley pulls it off well. So
and she's really
I like
given
them.
Almost nothing to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's a scene, really. Orlando Bloom, there's one scene really that made me realize, like, okay, this is what the rest of the movie needed, was just cohesive problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you've got the Kraken. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
The
there's a dispute over the pronunciation.
No, it's the Kraken.
The sea monster.
Yeah.
And really, Orlando Bloom has to fight the sea monster.
Uh-huh.
It's a very simple problem. But he gets the whole crew to do what it needs to do to defeat the Kraken.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like that 10-minute sequence is the most coherent sequence in the movie because it's like, here's our problem. The Kraken's going to attack. Here's how he's going to attack. Orlando Bloom's telling you, okay, this is what we have to do, da-da-da-da-da.
And it works.
And it's so satisfying.
Yeah.
It's like 10 minutes. The rest of the movie, honestly, we were 120 minutes into this, and I was I literally looked at my watch. I was like, I don't know how much longer.
I couldn't believe how long the movie dragged on and how long it did assault me. I really, honestly, I felt
and
like the NASCAR race.
Do we really have to see the third one?
No, we don't. And I want to say, that's my last point, where the knife in my back, adding the insult to the injury of this movie, was having to get to the end of the film and them leaving it completely open. Not that there's anything that needs to be resolved, but introducing this point where then you realize that this entire film has just been a prelude to the third film. And I thought about, well, why doesn't that bother me with Lord of the Rings movies? Or why doesn't it bother me with Empire Strikes Back? That leaves with a lot of threads open and you're going to get the third film. But you know what? In X2 even, you can find all these trilogy examples that end that way. But you know what? They were all satisfying in their own way.
Right.
And they ended in a way where, yes, they left things open, but there was some resolution to what was going on. Here, they literally, at the end of this film, introduce a character just specifically to set up the whole film.
That's
and it feels
that's,
like
that's,
it feels like you get to the end of the film just to have that moment so that then you can go see the third movie.
I couldn't help but see it as just a money-making scheme.
It is.
I don't want to be cynical about that, but that's what it feels like, the whole thing.
Yep.
And I want an apology from everyone that didn't like Superman and claimed to be more excited about this.
Okay. Fair enough.
All right. If you've seen Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
After the break, Why the World Doesn't Need Superman returns. Listeners continue the debate Sam and I started last week and shame us with their top 5 movie scores next in listener feedback. Plus, stick around for your chance to win a free DVD in Massacre Theater.
Where did I begin? Well, I don't really care. There's plenty of faces along the way who'd be glad. Is it your fault or just my fault? Well, it don't matter anymore. You carve our names on window panes and leave them scattered on the floor. If the melody escapes me, I will stumble upon it soon. If it's not a
welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. There's no PeerFlix DVD this week, but sign up for a PeerFlix account now, and you'll be entered to win the Criterion Collection edition of Yee Yee. Sam, you love this movie. Tell listeners why they should want this movie if they haven't seen it.
Yeah, Edward Yang's, I think it came out in 2000. This is a favorite film of mine. Now being more familiar with somebody like Ozu, you can't help but see the influence on somebody like Edward Yang in Yee Yee. But it's a very simple story, a Taiwanese family at a moment of sort of everyday crisis, which I know doesn't sound like the most compelling thing in the world, but really is the way he captures the everyday lives of these people is absolutely incredible. And it's a really, really moving story. So if you get it, win the DVD from PeerFlix. Maybe you don't need to see it again, but you need to see it once. It's fantastic. Possible candidate for Film Spotting You, honestly.
Could be. Yee Yee Criterion comes out next Tuesday, along with Basic Instinct 2, Risk Addiction.
I've got an addiction.
I bet. Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story, and Protocols of Zion. Sam, you wanted to single out this film?
Well, just this documentary that came out. It's a really interesting-looking documentary about the rise of anti-Semitism in the U.S. after 9/11. Looked interesting, something that I missed at the time, but something that's worth catching up on DVD.
It is coming out this Tuesday.
PeerFlix is a new way to get DVDs cheap. It's only 99 cents every time you get a DVD in the mail, and over 200,000 DVDs are available on the network. Sign up and start trading now at peerflix.com/filmspotting or at filmspotting.net.
Okay, it's time now to thank our listeners who have been so generous, Sam. They went to the filmspotting.net site, clicked the PayPal link, and threw a few bucks our way. They are.
And we do appreciate it. And they are Leonie, Last Pirate on the Liffey, Michael, Pegleg, Plankwalk, Alfred, Aqua Heart, Aqua Lung, and a Gold Club member, Nicholas, Rum Drunk Booty Call. Thank you so much for donating this week to Film Spotting.
And I love the Jethro Tull.
Right? Aqua Heart, Aqua
Lung.
Reference
there. Very, very well done.
And, you know, maritime themes in accordance with our...
You did a fine job,
yeah.
As usual. Sam, last week's poll question, we were really asking listeners to help dictate the content they are going to get on upcoming editions of Film Spotting. Our poll question was, after the Screwball Comedies Marathon that's coming up and the Documentaries Marathon that's going to follow that, which marathon should we do next?
Yeah, and you came in resoundingly, as expected, we have to be honest, with animation at 63%. Or, Adam, do you want to give this pronunciation a try?
Anime?
Anime.
Yeah.
Anime at 63%. Coming in behind animation, the works of John Cassavetes at 21%, and then at 16%, Bollywood Indian films, which, according to this poll, we may never get to.
We may never get to.
But Cassavetes, I certainly hope we do. And several listeners wrote in and said, it's really time you did the Cassavetes. A lot of people that are excited about this. So I think we'll see it in a future marathon.
I think it's safe to say it will probably follow the animation marathon. Yes. And we said anime because, as we've been discussing in our message boards with a few people who have been throwing out, they looked at the website and saw that animation was running away with it. It really probably should be an anime marathon because that's the area that we're most interested in, other than the
just
Iron
Giant. The point
Giant.
Of marathons, really. Yeah,
yeah. To explore something we know nothing about, and we don't know anything about it.
Opening ourselves up to ridicule
absolutely.
By those people that are so passionate about this genre.
Yeah, it could be very scary, but we're willing to try. And so we would also like your input on this. Again, as I was saying, The Iron Giant's a film that we both would like to check out. Yeah. There's obviously not anime.
Right.
But the anime films, Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away, those are the films we really want to get into. And we've actually set up a separate forum on our message boards. You can go to filmspotting.net, click the boards link. There is a new forum for marathon suggestions / discussions. You can propose new marathon ideas, as many of you have, through email. And you can also put in films that you think should be part of the animation marathon. Right. So if you have some real hardcore thoughts about this marathon,
and
please,
we know some of you do.
Yeah, please go ahead and put them in there. We also want to read this week's poll question, Sam, tying in with A Scanner Darkly, the new Richard Linklater film we'll be reviewing on next week's show. We asked, what is Richard Linklater's best film?
Yeah, and of course your choices are Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Dazed and Confused, School of Rock, Slacker, or Waking Life, the very best Richard Linklater film. That's this week's poll.
And Sam, your vote right now is going to
Before Sunset. It was really difficult. I mean, I talked just a little while ago. Now I can't remember which top five it was. Where Dazed and Confused was the number one film in the top five.
Yeah, I'm drawing a blank too.
But it's a very good film. Ensemble films, I believe, actually.
Probably.
Dazed and Confused was number one. It's a film I really love that I've revisited several times, but I really can't help but think of the impression that Before Sunset, the most recent Before Ethan Hawke, Julie Delpy film, for the fact that it has maybe the very best last scene in any movie I've ever seen. That alone, just the impression it leaves on me. But it's really a really moving film and a surprising film, too. Well, we talked about, you know, we're going to be talking later in the show about movies we thought we'd hate. I didn't think I'd hate Before Sunset necessarily, but I really didn't expect to be as moved by it as I was.
It's funny because I think Before Sunrise will probably beat out Before Sunset. People will probably go back to the
nostalgic
one.
Yeah, sure.
And that's totally fair. And we did separate them because we wanted to see which one people preferred. But you're right. I think my vote right now is going actually to Before Sunset as well. It's a film I equally loved, and it's funny. A couple weeks ago, I was flipping channels late at night on TV, and usually being movie buffs, a movie starts, even if we've never seen the movie before, you see the credits. You know, you don't even see the credits. You just see the opening scenes, and you know what movie it is. You don't even know who's in it yet, but you know what film it is.
Right.
Well, this movie starts, and you're seeing all these shots of these city streets, and it kind of looks like it could be New York, but it could also be Paris, and I'm drawing a blank. I don't know what film this is. And then it finally kicks in a little bit, and I realize that it's Before Sunset. And I'm laying there in bed. It's, you know, I got to go to work the next morning. It's like 1 a.m. Yeah. I shouldn't be watching this. And I said to myself, well, just watch a few minutes. You're not going to get caught up in this. You love the movie, but come on. It's just two people walking around and sitting around talking.
Any recipe for sleep,
Yeah, you are not going to be into this film. I swear to God, I ended up watching about half of it,
That's amazing.
I sat there the whole time with a smile on my face.
Yeah.
I mean, I was that caught up in that movie despite it being 1 a.m. and being tired. So I do love that film. It'd get my vote, too. We also want to announce this week's Dope Sheet winner. Each week, we give out a copy of Keith Jenkins and the Moving Parts self-titled CD, courtesy of Reverbose Records. And this week's winner is Ed Ross. He's a Dope Sheet subscriber, gets our weekly email blast. Randomly chosen winner, Ed Ross, congratulations. Send us an email, and we'll get the CD sent out to you. We also need to address the Screwball Comedies Marathon.
Yes.
As we talked about, it is our next marathon.
Right.
Briefly, we just want to say this again. You can go to the marathons page on our website. But with the Herzog-Kinski Marathon officially ending in our next segment with our awards, the Screwball Comedies Marathon is coming up. So get them added to Netflix, Peerflix, whatever you use. If you want to play along, start watching these movies. Sam, you want to list them real quick?
Yeah, in order, we will be watching The Thin Man, directed by W.S. Van Dyke, based on, of course, the Dashiell Hammett novel with William Powell and Myrna Loy. Then we've got My Man Godfrey, directed by Gregory LaCava with William Powell again and Carol Lombard, and then a Cary Grant double feature, The Awful Truth and Bringing Up Baby, the first directed by Leo McCarey, and then the Howard Hawks film, of course. Then we've got Preston Sturges' Sullivan's Travels, followed by Preston Sturges' The Lady Eve, and rounding it out, Adam's Rib, directed by George Cukor, and starring, of course, Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. Spencer Tracy.
We couldn't. And just a couple notes here I want to mention. My Man Godfrey was a film that wasn't initially in our lineup, but because of our top five performances of all time with Dylan Kidd, it was one of his all-time favorite comedic performances. Is Carol Lombard, and you also mentioned a relative,
mine who just is obsessed with the Turner movie classics. Always mentions that.
So we thought we should include that. And also, Sam, you've been talking lately about Adam's Rib, and maybe it's 8 years apart from The Lady Eve, and maybe we should have included something else. But I'm really sticking to this because of the fact that I don't think you can do a Screwballs Comedies marathon without getting into George Cukor and having a Hepburn Tracy film. So I really want to do it. And we also want to address those people who've been sending in emails about the marathon saying, I really wish you'd do some more modern screwball comedies. Why not movies like There's Something About Mary and something like that? Well, we like that movie, and we've seen it. But also, with these marathons, we are trying to get more specific than maybe we even have been in the past, where our Westerns covered 40 years and musicals covered 40 years. We really want to get into screwball comedies when they actually were a genre. This is what Hollywood was turning out, just like when they were turning out Westerns. We're not really looking for the revisionist or the new screwball comedies. We want to get into the movies that somehow we have managed to miss over the course of our film-loving lives. So that's what we're doing. And again, we'd love to have you play along if you are interested. And with that, Sam.
Oh, God.
Superman
returns.
I suggested last week, we returned to Superman. I suggested last week that I was going to get burned at the stake.
Yeah,
I was totally prepared.
Yeah, I was afraid for you.
Yeah, to just be lambasted by our listeners for disliking Superman as much as I did, much to my
really crushing
surprise.
A 10-year-old's dream live on air.
And
it turns out everyone wants to crush the 10-year-old's dream of mine.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not entirely alone, but it felt like it at times. I don't think we have ever received as many emails as we did about Superman Returns. I don't think we've received that many emails with anything else. Really.
We haven't, in terms of a single movie.
A single film, really, generating this kind of response, and at length in many cases. And I think it's just because a lot of people went into this film with a lot of expectations, a lot of nostalgia on the line, a lot of people felt burnt by it, felt like it was very boring, as we'll get into. I just went through a general look through like the numbers of emails that we got, and really it really is very favorable in Adam's court here. I think it's probably like a third to two-thirds balance of like two-thirds negative. I hated Superman. It was a disappointment to the one-third core nostalgists like myself.
Mm-hmm. So I was surprised by that, very surprised. And we just want to acknowledge real quick, too, Alan Jackson in Hickory, North Carolina, had the great title of his email. He actually sent it as a story, Why the World Does Not Need Superman Returns, which, Sam, you came up with for the little tease going into the break. You hadn't actually seen that in Alan's email, but you guys are on the same page.
And although we disagree.
He has a great email here that's very long, so we're going to get to a few shorter ones, including this one from Andrew Black, who says, Adam, I couldn't agree with you more. Like most of the critics, the boy shucks golly idealism and lack of cynicism blinded Sam to the glaring weaknesses of the film. As a superhero flick, this falls between such average but interesting mid-90s movies like The Shadow, Spawn, and The Phantom. Now those are fighting words, Sam. At least those movies...
At least you brought up George Lucas as besting Bryan Singer, but...
At least those movies gave their lesser heroes something interesting to do. What in the name of the Daily Planet made Singer and his writers decide to come up with a movie that decide the world needs Superman, then have Superman constantly needing saving by first Lois Lane's boring-ass husband-to-be and next medical science? I can't believe that they went forward with this story. What worked about the X-Men movies was that they adapted them from the fascinating lore of the graphic novels. This Superman seems to be a screenwriter's concoction, and it was boring and formulaic. I found it an arrogant decision because it seems so removed from the rich history of the comics. Too bad, because I too like Brandon Routh and the sense of nostalgia Singer worked hard to provide. Good call, Adam. Sam, I wish you had a heart of kryptonite instead of coal.
And like a kryptonite shiv in my back, I'll continue to read on this response. Brett Merriman in Menlo Park, California writes, Adam, spot on across the board. The first 5 minutes of Superman Returns, I was buzzing. I was so excited. Then the Lex Luthor stuff started, and the film lost me. The bad guy plot from start to finish was abysmal. My points would just duplicate your point, so I'll just add a thought onto the lack of updating this movie. Superman in 1978 was a really bold character. He was a squeaky clean all-American in a more cynical post-Nam era. He really stood out in that world as someone to emulate. Bryan Singer really played this one tight. It seems he didn't want to make a mistake. But I would have loved Superman's role, his message, to be updated for this post-9/11 world. or even for our modern era. I kept wondering why he needed to get his newspaper job back, or why he had to have an alter ego, or why no one can recognize him. Yes, these are parts of the Superman mythos, but let's find cool scenes to deal with each one, make them relevant again. Instead, Superman and Bryan Singer turned out to be lazy. Brett Merriman, Menlo Park,
California. Thank you, Brett. I thought that was a really insightful email.
It's
interesting.
It raises some, yeah.
I had some of those same thoughts, actually, about the updating of it. Things felt really antiquated. And some of those things where I was asking myself, too, why does he even need a job at the Daily Planet? I'm not following this.
And I guess it's true. I mean, I can't argue. I don't want to argue necessarily, or didn't feel like arguing with the idea that this is a myth. And I made that point last week, and I think it's valid in that Singer was treating this whole story as a myth, you know, which was maybe a story in 1978. He's treating his myth because, you know, thousands of kids grew up watching it, and it worked for me.
Okay. Well, this one from Steph in L.A., Sam, she was with you.
Yeah, she was.
She says she's usually 100% in agreement with me, but as a lifelong fan of overwatching Superman, she has to admit Sam is right. Superman Returns is slightly flawed, but it didn't matter. The whole point of the movie is Superman living up to the expectations of his father and the supreme loneliness he feels in a world of lesser beings, not the story flaws and lame supporting characters. I mean, that flashback of him bouncing through the fields, I would have done the same thing, and it was wondrous. I actually thought that scene was really lame and a bad ripoff of the original Superman scene of him running through the fields, running along by the train. Personally, I thought the storyline kind of blew. I didn't like Kevin Spacey's character, and if I see one more lingering shot of Parker Posey's wheels turning, I'll hurl. But truly, the Superman character was compelling enough for me to turn away from all those flaws, and it was the most fascinating part of the film. Brandon Routh was wonderful and perfect as Superman. I think Adam might be jealous. Don't know.
Yes, that's right.
I just can't believe Adam has gotten so jaded that he couldn't find the same magic in a film as Sam. What the F?
What the F, Adam? What the F, all you haters out there?
They want to know.
I guess they do. All right, one more here from Andrew Fung, who also liked the film. Writes, I am forced to write as Adam's normally true heart is way off dial. How can you say that George Lucas's muddled and meaningless Anakin Skywalker movies are better than Bryan Singer's Superman Returns? I'll take one Bryan Singer film over any current George Lucas film any day, thanks. Normally, I side with Adam as a moderate film freak as opposed to Sam's iconoclast, but I have to go with the Sam camp on this. I absolutely loved Singer's direction, all the beatific, iconic scenes straight from yesterday in today's comics pages. The action sequences were spectacular, of a scope that they challenge even Superman. We see that even with his powers, that an earthquake may actually be beyond his capabilities, that even he needs some luck on his side. The solution to Luther's plan is the one thing that doesn't jibe with the rest of the film. It's the typical super solution, but I'm willing to overlook it, and so was I. Largely.
I think he overlooked a lot. And believe me, I would take any number of Bryan Singer's previous films over any George Lucas film, at least recent
but
George Lucas
Superman
film.
But not Superman Returns.
But not Superman Returns. And again, I'm just as shocked. This is the theme for this show.
Yeah.
I'm just as surprised as you are that I would actually say that Revenge of the Sith is a better film than Superman Returns, which another very flawed movie, but it is a better movie. That's all I can say about it, sir.
All right. Well, I mean, we can continue this debate, and I'm sure our listeners will continue
and we will, because as we said, we received maybe the most feedback ever about this one movie about Superman Returns, and we just can't get into it all, but maybe in this week's dope sheet we'll try to get into a few more listener responses. Okay, well, we have some great top five scores feedback that we're going to push back to our top five segment when we get into our top five at the end of the show, so we'll save that feedback. And if you do have any feedback for us, send us an email or short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net, or give us a call at 206-203-CINNA. That's 206-203-2463. We'd love to hear from you.
When we come back, the award for best performance by a starving child or an insane person on the fiddle goes to Adam and I bid farewell to the Herzog-Kinski Marathon with Our Best Fiends, plus another round of Massacre Theater, and a look at The Groomsman from writer, director, actor Ed Burns. Stay with us.
I was drunk. I was down. I was wandering around my bed. I was drunk. I was down. I was wandering around my bed. I called out your name. Call out your name. I was bleeding. I was exhausted. I was suffering from the altitude. Picked up your scent and lost it. Then I suffered from your attitude and called out your name. Call out.
you?
I was a child. I was in love. It was wrong and you knew it.
You knew what you were doing.
Now I do. This is my place. Get out. Mohan, Demigru, Bolianu.
I did what I did. You don't have to be happy about it, but maybe we can help each other out now. I need one of the pieces your father collected. Bronze piece about this size with a hole in it off center with a crystal. You know the one I mean?
Yeah, I know it.
Thanks for tuning in to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Hallgren. Time now for Massacre Theater. Last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from...
Da 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 da.
That's right, Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Thank you, Ross Woolman, for that. I mean, a lot of other people couldn't help themselves. Actually, wrote in that dun 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 dun.
That's true.
Took the time to do what everyone was saying at their computer.
He had the moxie to actually sing it. It was fantastic.
That was fantastic. Of course, with Harrison Ford and Karen Allen, a tie-in with last week's top five movie scores. Adam, reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is David Hahn, or maybe David Han, from Whittier, California. Congratulations, David. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
Before we jump into this scene, I do want to briefly just point out, some listeners wrote in and said, man, that acting was not only massacred, Adam and Sam, but the script was massacred.
That's your good
from
point.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's fair.
And it is fair. I was sitting there with you the morning we were picking out the script, and I said...
We called an expert and tried to confirm
it. Yeah, I said, that just doesn't scan right. And I called my friend, who's a diehard, you know, movie nut, Raiders of the Lost Ark freak, and he said, no, that's really close enough. And it turns out if you do listen to the scene, it is close enough. There are some extra things in there, bits of dialogue, but the bulk of the lines, the screenplay we found was actually pretty close, but I just wanted to acknowledge that. This week's edition of Massacre Theater, though, not tying in, as it usually does, with our top five, again, movies we should have hated, but rather an idea that we had and originally we're going to go with, top five nautical movies, and I just briefly want to read this email, Sam, from Carter Nixon at Wingnut Films, basically because anytime someone from Wingnut Films actually emails
we're
going to read the email. And he says, you could always, for the week you review pirates, have a top five nautical movies, films set on the sea, films set under the sea, films about the sea, or just water-based films. And
we were
going to go with it because I did love, we were trying to think of, okay, water movies, top five movies about the sea. A lot of listeners, you guys wrote in with that suggestion. We liked it and we just decided it was kind of boring. It wasn't the kind of thing where how many people are really passionate about nautical movies, whereas movies that you went in with low expectations ended up loving and still rave about, we all have
them. We imagine. We're excited to hear what yours were.
So tying in, though, with nautical movies.
Yes.
That's what this one ties in with.
That's right.
Nautical movies, this week's scene, and action.
Blank here is into music in a big way, and he views this whole boat as his own personal private stereo set. Well, one day, he's got this piece of Pavarotti.
It was Paganini.
Whatever.
It was Paganini.
Hey, look, this is my story, okay?
Then tell it right. Pavarotti is a tenor. Paganini was a composer.
Yeah, so anyway, he's got this music out in the water, and he's listening to it on his headsets, and he's just happy as a clam. And then all hell breaks loose. See, there's this whole slew of boats out in the water.
Including one way out at Pearl.
Including one way at the hell out of Pearl. All of a sudden, they start hearing Pavarotti coming up their asses.
And scene. I like Sam Hallgren as a blowhard. That works. If you know what film Sam and I just massacred,
it's a nautical
send us
term,
an email.
Isn't it? Blowhard?
Yeah, blowhard?
I think it is.
I think so.
Yeah.
Send us an email by Monday, July 17th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show.
3 days away, cuz, you lucky bastard.
Lucky.
Yeah, lucky. Beautiful girl, baby on the way. I'd say that's lucky, man. That's real lucky.
Living together for a couple of years, you know, I think it's gonna be all right.
What the hell are you worried about? Getting married.
Yo!
Hey! Look, Mike, it's 3 days, all right? All you gotta do is just be cordial to him, okay?
I can't do that.
Why not?
Because I don't know what cordial means.
10 years after The Brothers McMullen, many filmgoers still associate the name Ed Burns with his first film. McMullen took place in suburban Long Island, where Burns was raised. In the five films Burns has written and directed since then, he's largely used the streets of New York City as his primary setting. With The Groomsman, his latest, Burns has returned to familiar territory, the suburbs of working-class Long Island. In the film, Burns plays Polly, who's 3 days away from getting married to Brittany Murphy's Sue. In the days leading up to the wedding, Polly and the groomsmen, played by Jay Moore, Donald Logue, Matthew Lillard, and John Leguizamo, come to terms with getting older, have a few beers, and resolve old conflicts. Adam, you're a married man. Did The Groomsman ring true to you?
Yeah, absolutely. It did. And I have to say that if you look back at the films Ed Burns has made, I've really been a fan of all of them. The only film that didn't really work for me is She's the One, his second film after The Brothers McMullen. And it's funny because he gets compared a lot to Woody Allen, of course, who is a favorite filmmaker of ours. And so maybe it's not a surprise that someone who loves Woody Allen would also like Ed Burns' movies. There are a lot of similarities.
Sure.
But for me, I don't look at it as a bad thing. I see it as a positive. The same things I like about Woody's movies, I like about Ed Burns' movies. And this movie, I have to say, really did work for me. We're also into male bonding movies. We're going to talk about that in an upcoming top five. And this is a movie about guys getting back together, reuniting, and things kind of exploding a little bit when they're at this age where everyone is at a little bit different stage in their life, or at least a few of the guys are at different stages, and things kind of come together and blow up a little bit. And the big reason I do recommend people check out this film is for the cast, the ensemble cast, which you get a lot in Ed Burns' films. But you've got some great supporting actors here, guys who make up his group of guys, his friends from high school, John Leguizamo, as you mentioned, Jay Moore, Matthew Lillard is really good in this. And also Donald Logue is a guy we both like a lot. He's fantastic in this too. So there are a lot of things I liked about this film. But the big thing that really struck me is this film was really being sold as a movie about adulthood, these men coming to adulthood. But I think much more specifically than that, it's a movie about masculinity. And it's something you don't really see explored that much in films. I'm kind of drawing a blank, actually, and coming up with any that really that really explore this topic and kind of the dilemma of the modern male, if you will. And that's what this film really deals with. This is a movie where characters are constantly dictating to the other characters what it means to be a man.
Yeah.
You know, one character says it means moving out. That's what being a grown man is, being out on your own, starting your own family. You can't care about baseball and comics. If you care about that stuff, you're not a real man. You know, you don't talk about romantic stuff. There's a fantastic line in the film where he's talking to Jay Moore, and he tells the story of how he met his fiancée, Brittany Murphy, and Jay says, "That's a great story. Why didn't you ever tell me that before?" And he says, "You know, those things just don't come up." And it's a great line, and it's true. Those things don't really come up. So there are a lot of moments like that where this kind of masculinity crisis, in a way, is what I think the film really deals with, and it's what drew me in.
Yeah, I mean, I really like the cast a lot. And I was thinking really about Brothers McMullen, which is, you know, the film that made, obviously, the first impression on us of Ed Burns. And I was thinking about the impression it did make on me at the time, looking back 10 years now. And it's really what he captures, what he's so good about capturing is how guys talk to each other, particularly in the case of Brothers McMullen, how brothers talk to each other. And when I heard that, you know, The Groomsman was coming out, I had this strange sense of kind of relief in a way that I hadn't approached previous films of his, because it's very familiar ground. You know it without knowing anything about the movie. The movie's called The Groomsman. You know it's going to be about a bunch of guys on Long Island, you know, and this is stuff that Burns knows through and through. And I liked so much about McMullen. And I was thinking about the thing is, and looking back at Brothers McMullen, I had forgotten, really, about the sort of dramatic story of the brother who gets into the extramarital affair. It really was the guys talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, The Groomsman, the stuff that works, and thankfully it's the bulk of the film, really, is just the guys hanging out. Wonderful, wonderful opening scene of just the group of guys being reunited at a bar. And when they leave the bar completely, you know, having polished off a bottle of whiskey, it captures a moment of, like, you know, you're in your mid-30s, but you're still screaming at your top of the lungs 2 o'clock in the morning in a neighborhood, and it's like, oh, man, I've been there.
I've been there.
And there are a lot of really nice scenes with this. And for me, one scene really sticks out that's both a really nice scene but also points to some things that I'm not sure really worked for me. And it's a scene in the middle of the film. Again, we have the group of guys sitting around a table, and they're just telling stories. They're having drinks. And again, it's almost uncanny how these actors capture the idea of, like, knowing each other. They've known each other forever. And again, you've got Jay Moore, John Leguizamo, Matthew Lillard, and you really believe it. Donald Logue and Ed Burns are uncanny as brothers. They look exactly alike. And they're telling funny stories, and all of a sudden it gets to Donald Logue, who, you know, is really having a hard time. We've learned this throughout the film, and, you know, he's having a hard time at home. He's been fired from a couple jobs, and he starts telling a story that he's been set up to tell the story. And it's supposed to be a funny story. It could be told in a very funny way. and it becomes very dramatic. Mm-hmm. And of course, it reveals a lot about the character. And the fact that, you know, all of a sudden you have these bunch of guys that are laughing and slapping each other on the back, and all of a sudden everyone goes silent.
They get serious.
And it's awkward and serious. And I feel a little bit like the movie has... The fact that everybody has an issue that needs to be resolved, and that the effort to resolve all those issues by the time the movie ends, to me, felt just a little forced. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we needed everybody to have their own separate issue that they were dealing with. But of course, like you said, these four guys that have known each other their whole life, maybe they see each other off and on, but you know, you have somebody entering a new stage of their life, it's a time to reflect. So you can imagine some of these coming out. You know, Jay Moore's character still living with his dad, still doing the same job he did when he was 17, and you can see his cousin is getting married. Where am I? You know, he's still stalking his ex-girlfriend, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And then you've got Matthew Lillard, who's like, best days were in high school, and it's, he still wants to live in that, despite the fact he has two kids and he's married. And for me, it's, I had a hard time with the struggle to resolve all these conflicts that were raised, but at the same time, the pleasure of watching four guys, you know, and capturing that certainly made the film worth watching for me.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that you mention that scene about them walking out. This is really, I've read some interviews with Ed where he said this is kind of a love letter in a way to the suburbs. He's made a lot of movies about New York City, and he lives in the city, but he grew up here, as you said, and he does think that it usually gets a bad rap in the way it's depicted. Right. And I think he's probably right. Here you really get, I mean, from the opening aerial shot of this place, it seems like...
The Best of Both Worlds, I think, is the song.
Yes, Best of Both Worlds is the song, and it seems very blue-collar and working class, and yet it does seem... angelic or idyllic. It does seem like a place you would want to be. And I do love the fact that, yes, they walk out of the bar and they're stumbling down the middle of the street. And I don't know if many of our female listeners will get into this movie that much. They may not, because it is obviously a guy-centered movie. There are female characters. Brittany Murphy's in it, but they're mainly relegated to, well, the house in a way. Yeah. I mean, she's kind of stuck there. You know, she's very pregnant and about to have a baby. And you just don't see a lot of women in this film. It's a guy movie. And again, it's about this kind of emasculation idea. That scene that you described gets very, very somber because it's about emasculation. It's about a nun humiliating a man, a boy, and making him feel like less than even a boy. Right. And so those themes always come up, which did interest me. But I just want to get back again to that idea real quick of, you know, we have some mutual friends in St. Louis. And I've been there. I'm sure you have too.
Yeah.
Where, you know what? It's totally ridiculous.
Jeffy and Brian.
You're out with Jeffy and Brian. It even sounds like they should be in this movie, right?
I was thinking of the Dan Byrne concert in Madison. Were you there?
No, I missed that one. I was with them the night before in Ames.
Okay.
And we've been to St. Louis. And we've been to St. Louis, and we've been together, and you get out the cigars. You don't even smoke cigars, but you get them out, and you smoke like 10 of them. Yeah. And you drink some beer, and you just walk around the neighborhood. Being really obnoxious and telling stories.
Yeah.
And you know what? Maybe, I don't know if women do that or not, but we do. And those moments of authenticity are in this film, and they're really dead on. And so I also give the movie and Ed Burns a lot of credit too for its soundtrack. I think it's a great soundtrack with some new music, but a lot of older music too. And again, I just think it's one of those things Ed Burns gets right, that these characters all played in a band together.
Right.
And we see them practicing. They're going to reunite for the show. And they're working on these songs, and they're playing songs that really, if you look at their ages, these are songs that they were 10, 11, 12 when they came on. They're not the songs that were popular when they were in high school. And that is another thing. It's just I played in a band all through junior high and high school. And that's what we played. The songs that we loved playing when we were in junior high. You know, for us, it was hair metal. But for them, it's, you know, it's Billy Squire and that kind of stuff. And Eddie Money. And so I think, again, that's just something Ed knows these people. He knows the environment and he gets it right.
I love, too, that, and I think we all have a friend like this, where it's like Matthew Lillard, his gift to Ed Burns for his wedding is to reunite the band and play at the wedding.
Right.
It's like, we all have that guy. It's like, I don't know, you might be the only one that wants to get the band back together, but it's your gift, so okay.
Yeah,
we'll
exactly.
play at the band.
Exactly. I think if there are any criticisms I had of the film, is that we don't get to know enough about Paulie, about Ed Burns' character. He's a guy who we don't hear really about any family except his brother and his job.
No, you're talking about it's 3 days before the wedding and there's no mom and dad.
And even his job, we get mentions to the fact that he writes for a newspaper. We know he's a writer. But again, you never really feel, and again, in a movie that's very authentic and feels like it has all the details down, to not really have a sense of what he does for a living, really, other than being a newspaper guy, was something that was lacking for
me. But for me, I'm 4 weeks out from my wedding and I know how involved the parents are. So I don't know. I mean, Ed Burns' character, Paulie, is a little bit older in life. He's maybe 35.
Right.
So maybe he's doing this all alone, but I happen to know the parents it's a little get different. Involved in the you know.
Yeah. So anyway, The Groomsman, it's a film that opens actually a couple of days after we're posting this show. It opens on Friday, July 14th, but only in LA and New York. It will be expanding to select cities. And actually, you should look for an interview that we'll be doing with Ed Burns in about 2 weeks for the last Saturday of the month when we do our WBEZ Chicago Public Radio edition of the show. The Tuesday before that, I believe it's the 24th maybe, when our show, Tuesday or Wednesday, when our show goes up, we'll have that interview with Ed Burns and discuss this movie with him a little bit. So I say it's absolutely worth checking out, and I agree with you too that it's one that was kind of nice to return to familiar ground with him. Well, we wanted to get in, Sam, to the Herzog Awards. We have feedback to get to. The show
we
is getting
so much.
Backlogged. We'll get to those things. And our top five movies we should have hated coming up next. Stay with us.
Place gas and nets. She works without a net. I like her better when she walks away. She said she was mine. She told me twice. I like her better when she walks away. Yeah, I like her better when she walks away.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Sam Haldren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and we're going to get to our top five movies we should have hated in a little bit here. But first, we want to start with our Herzog-Kinski Marathon Awards. We're calling them our best fiends.
That's right.
And Sam, you joked about it in the tease there after segment one, but the first category...
I've awarded one.
Best performance by a starving child or insane person playing the fiddle.
Or the flute.
Or the flute.
It's tough. I mean, but... For me, it was, and again, I go back and watch these films, there is an insane person or starving child performing the fiddle or the flute in every single one of these movies. And for me, though, it is the opening scene, actually, of Cobra Verde.
Yes.
Where we have the starving, mildly crazed guy telling us the story of Cobra Verde, setting up the myth of Cobra Verde on the fiddle and doing the slide fiddle or something like that. And it's actually really engrossing.
It's really excruciating, Sam.
And excruciating. I honestly, after a while, I mean, it's excruciating. And just like many of the experience of watching many of Herzog's films, excruciating. But then it honestly, for me, and maybe this is one of the reasons I like Cobra Verde so much, it did work in terms of setting up the myth.
Okay. Well, I also went with Cobra Verde, but the
what
sound.
What about the starving child that was playing the fiddle in Nosferatu, hauntingly?
No, I went with Cobra Verde. I think
what about the crazy guy in Aguirre who, when Aguirre is like, play the flute?
Sam, we've got a lot to get to on this show here, okay? Next category, best long march through the jungle.
Yeah. My best fiend goes to Aguirre. Really, it is just a phenomenal opening shot. Really, the opening shot of the film, where the entire army marching down Machu Picchu, and really we get this, you know, we get just these small figures marching down, and then he reveals really how large this group of people are, and it's absolutely mind-boggling. And for me, you know, one of the redeeming things about Aguirre, which wasn't a film that worked for me overall, but that shot in particular is just fantastic.
Yeah, it is incredible. And of course, my best fiend as well goes to Aguirre. I have a feeling we're going to agree on this next one as well, Sam. Best supporting performance.
Oh.
These are largely Klaus Kinski vehicles,
that's
obviously.
Right.
But
best performance
best
by somebody that wasn't Kinski.
Yeah.
I have to give it to Eva Mattes in Wojciech.
Okay.
Are we in agreement there? We're not.
No,
are you
going to
go somewhere else?
Yes.
Okay. For me, yes. You're going with Nosferatu, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Yes, you are. Well, for me, Wojciech really is... I mean, yes, again, it's a Kinski vehicle. And thinking about the supporting roles, just thinking about awarding a supporting role, you realize how much Herzog's films are focused on the role of Kinski, the character that Kinski is playing. But Eva Mattes as Wojciech's wife or lover, mother
common
law wife, is really fantastic. And again, I think we're going to mention this a few times, but in My Best Fiend, we got shown a few... He uses a couple clips from a couple other movies, in particular one from Wojciech, and it's a scene, a long, long scene, uncut scene between Kinski and Mattes, and it's just, you realize just the power of both their acting.
And just for all of our listeners out there, our real stickler listeners, because this is the last time we may ever utter
Wojciech.
It, I'll go ahead and say Wojciech.
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 Okay.
I think we'll go ahead and say it, even though we've been butchering it the entire time. Okay, my best supporting performance has to go to Isabella Gianni for Nosferatu. She's haunting. She's gorgeous. I mean, in a really interesting way. I mean, again, it's not a matter of just that she's beautiful, because she's actually kind of bizarre looking, but that's what draws you in. She's magnetic in a similar way that the vampire is. They actually, like I said during our review, look almost the same. She's just very ethereal and spooky in a way, and I think she gives a great performance with dialogue that you said is kind of heavy.
It's heavy, and it's also just to be able to walk a line between almost a silent film kind of performance. Yeah. And yeah.
Okay. Best Kinski performance. Sam,
how do you do it? How do you do it? And yet I am going with Wojcik. I'm just going to say that Wojcik movie. It was the first time I realized how good he is, and made me want to re-examine Nosferatu and Aguirre, really, where it's such a different performance from, the film is different from the other films in the series, really, in terms of being so small, based on an existing work, the play, and I just think his subtlety, you know, is revealed in some way, in which we see really in every film, I guess you'd argue Cobra Verde, but it's really powerful stuff, and just the way he's allowed himself to sort of be humiliated by the whole thing.
No, I agree, he's great in Wojcik. My Kinski performance, though, my best fiend, goes to Fitzcarraldo, and I think for me it was the first one where you saw a different side, a more human side, even though you see touches of it.
Yeah.
You see flashes in all those films you mentioned, but really he was always playing heightened characters. He was playing a vampire. He's playing Aguirre, this menacing figure going down the river in the jungle, and playing Wojcik as a guy who's a little bit crazy, obviously. And here you actually played a guy who's crazy in his own way, but more he's kind of the flamboyant dreamer, you know, but he felt for the first time like a more normal human figure that you could really relate to and understand his dilemma. And I think, again, being a guy who isn't larger than life, and yet he somehow manages to bring that kind of larger than life feel to it, that's why I like Fitzcarraldo a lot.
And it's a part two where you can't imagine anyone else playing it.
No.
I mean, you could say that about a lot of these films, but particularly that, and the fact that we've actually seen someone else play it.
Jason Robards, if you watch My Best Fiend, the documentary, you see it, and as we said last week on the show, it doesn't hold up at all.
Yeah.
Okay, best film, Sam.
Best film of the series.
I know where you're going.
I have to. I mean, I said it when we reviewed it, and it is Cobra Verde, which I know sounds like I'm just trying to take the contrarian view.
You?
I am the iconoclast. But really, it was the film. There were a number of things. I want to say this. There are a number of things in every one of these films I liked and really came to like. Fitzcarraldo and Wojcik and Nosferatu. But this one worked for me. The kind of thing that was not working for me in other films, that mythological sense that he was building a myth, didn't work for me in the other films. I know it worked for you, but in Cobra Verde, it worked.
Well, my best film is Fitzcarraldo. I said it during our review that at the time it was my favorite one, and I think a big part obviously is that the Kinski performance was my favorite performance, but I think the grace and the beauty of it and just the ambition of it as an achievement, it's pretty remarkable. But even if you didn't know how real everything was, pulling that boat over the mountain, it would still have the same emotional, kind of visceral, visual impact, I think, if you saw it. So it's my favorite film.
Yeah, and the thing is, though, I thought about if there was one film I want to go back and see, it's Wojcik. I mean, it really, for me, is the one that, from start to finish, is the most consistent, and it sort of haunts me. I mean, just the performance, the way the music is used in it, and it's such a simple film, simple performance, that I feel like the other ones really require quite a bit of energy to get through.
No, that's a good point.
Wojcik is sort of like Herzog in a nutshell.
Yeah, I agree with that. The best moment you would only see, Sam, our last category here, in a Herzog movie, a Herzog
movie.
What is your best moment?
I have to say, in Fitzcarraldo, the moment really of the ship, the steamship, the 300-ton steamship entering the water. I don't know if I can compare that to any other experience I've had in films, in watching films. I mean, just, we discussed it when we were talking about Fitzcarraldo, but really the agony of not believing that it's actually going to happen, that they really pulled that thing over the mountain. And they do, and it enters the waters, and it's such a moment of perfect grace, you almost can't articulate it.
Yeah, well, my best moment, I thought about Fitzcarraldo, a lot of moments came up, but again, obviously, you came up with the category, Sam, and it's something that, as you mentioned, these kind of insane people playing the fiddle or starving
sure.
children or whatever, you're going to see these common things cropping up in Herzog's films. And the one thing for me that jumped out is like, okay, if I saw that on screen, I would always know it's a Herzog movie. And it's actually from Nosferatu, and it's the town square dance that happens. This just completely surreal dance that happens out in the courtyard in this town. And the people are all about to die. They all have the plague.
Yeah,
and yet there's this really bizarre dancing going on. I'm sure there's some insane person playing the fiddle
Absolutely.
Throughout it. And then
you also get...
along with that, the moment of the pig walking along.
I knew you were going to mention the defecating
pig. You have to. That's a Herzog staple there you see in the shot. And then kind of colliding with that, Sam, adjacent to that, the shot of all of the rats coming off the boat in Nosferatu overtaking the city. Again, Herzog's thing, nature taking over, and also Herzog's not being content with being small. It has to be big. It has to be huge. It's not just that there are 100 rats. Yeah, it's like 2,000 rats or more, you know, so, or 10,000.
I mean, guarantee he brought the plague to that city. I mean, he probably did, and he didn't care, which we had to leave off the category best exploitation of Native peoples. We'll leave that for another time.
Yeah.
But yeah, that does wrap up the Herzog-Kinski marathon.
I hope you had as much fun as we did.
We really
did.
It was hard,
but we did have a lot of fun with it.
As it should be.
Okay. Well, before we get into the top five, Sam, let's briefly touch on last week's top five a little bit. We did our top five movie scores, and I just have to admit right off the bat, I hated that top five before we even did it. I told you I did, because we both admitted we're both just guys who, even though there's a lot of movies, there's a lot of music we like from movies.
Right.
And some of it we listen to on our iPods or whatever. It's not something I'm hardcore about, as many of our listeners are. Yeah. And so a lot of times these things don't just jump out at me. And that's why a lot of our lists, or at least the picks on my list, felt not as much personal as they felt.
Yeah,
like
right.
They had to be big things, like the Magnificent Seven, things that you hear them and you know right away what they are. But I didn't like my list, even to the point where people wrote in about Platoon. You know, I know that George Delarue was the arranger and the conductor of it, and that it's, you know, a couple hundred-year-old song from Samuel Barber, Adagio for Strings. But the fact is, I associate it with Platoon.
Right.
I think everyone does when they hear it. And, of course, Delarue's arrangement and the way he orchestrates it is going to be different and conducts it than other versions you've heard.
Right.
But on the whole, does Platoon deserve to be on there with all these other movie scores?
Oh, hey.
Probably not.
Well, they're all subjective.
Well, maybe. But, okay, well, we got this one, Sam, from Lewis Kelly in Edmonton, Alberta.
Yeah, he writes, usually when I listen to your top fives, I expect to recognize maybe two or three films or soundtracks or actors or whatever total on both of your lists. I simply haven't seen as many films as you guys, and only a few names spring to mind when I hear the topic of each episode's top five. This week was no different. Outside of scores like Star Wars and Psycho, off the top of my head, I could only think of one movie with a score that deserved a spot on one of your top fives. Howard Shore's positively iconic music from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Okay, I lied. I guess that's three films, not one. Again, that's Lewis Kelly from Edmonton, Alberta,
Canada. And he went into great detail talking about some of the songs from that score. And, of course, Howard Shore, it is. It's great music. He was certainly not alone. I definitely could see why it would be on your list.
Yeah, and Lewis condemns us, actually, for leaving it off the list, condemns us to locked into a room with dueling banjos, struck on repeat for hours.
Wow.
Or days.
Wow. That would be
rough.
And
he wasn't alone. We heard from a few people who mentioned this.
Yes, absolutely. Aaron Malone. This one from Aaron Malone, who writes, your top five film scores are all commendable choices, but I was a little disappointed not to hear some love for one of my favorite film composers, Carter Burwell. In particular, Fargo, and my personal love being John Malkovich. Just put the DVD of Malkovich in your player and listen to the excerpt that plays over the title menu. It's amazing. And Aaron, again, this is why we said being shamed by our list.
I know.
And I came up with all these big, you know, iconic themes.
Boring choices,
right? The fact is, boring choices, and I hate it. I wish I could just strike that top five, because you're right, I love the music from Fargo, and I love the music in Being John Malkovich,
so
and Aaron, you're right, and I'm wrong.
All right, well, this one is from Chris Fry, who gives us his top four Danny Elfman Memorial List top five scores. He's got Randy Newman, Toy Story 1 and 2. He's got Wojciech Kilar, Bram Stoker's Dracula 2, James Horner's Aliens, and number one, Angelo Badalamenti, G, with Mulholland Drive, Twin Peaks, Firewalk With Me, Lost Highway, and Dark Water. How could you forget him? It's a great question.
No, it is. And again, feeling ridiculous. I mean, I love Twin Peaks. I love Lynch's use of Badalamenti in the Twin Peaks series, in the movie, in his other films, Blue Velvet. You get it there, and you're right. I have no excuse. I shouldn't have even recorded the segment, Sam.
Well,
I want to strike it from the record.
We could strike it from the record, but it is... You know, it's been imprinted on the minds of thousands and thousands of FilmSpot and listeners.
I'm sure.
Adagio Strings. It'll haunt you to your dying day.
It's going to.
They'll play it at your funeral.
Someone who discovers the show in 3 years is going to go back and listen to that episode.
Oh,
I'm going to get crap for it. But let's try to redeem ourselves now, Sam, with this week's top five.
My desert island. All time. Top five most memorable breakups.
Top five musical crimes perpetrated by Stevie Wonder in the 80s and 90s. Go.
And this is one, Sam, that really does tie in with Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
I'll explain why in a moment. But also, Andy Grisdale wrote in, one of our listeners, just a couple days ago and said, after watching Mean Girls for about the 8th time recently, I had an idea for a top 5 list. Top 5 films you thought you'd hate but actually really liked. Just a thought and probably a stupid one, because I can't think of any more myself. And it was funny because we just decided like that day that's what the top 5
really
list was.
It really was uncanny. And yeah. I demanded that that Andy get out of my head and our heads collectively.
Okay. So, and again, some other people too wrote that in, actually, a similar suggestion based on The Lake House being such a surprise for me. They thought maybe surprise movies would be good. So it is our surprise movies, movies we really went in assuming we'd hate, ended up liking. We can't wait to get your stories about movies where that happened with you. Sam, what movies just missed your cut?
All right. Well, I mean, you think about this. When I started approaching, I was really excited about this top five, but then I thought about it, and the fact is, you know, before Film Spotting, there was a movie you thought you'd hate. You don't see it. You don't see it. Yes. And it's rare that you're put in front of a movie that you think you're going to hate. And so I actually devoted to the quick movies that just missed my cut. I gave two movies that actually, movies I thought I'd hate that I was really surprised by during the Film Spotting era. And there are seven of them: 40-Year-Old Virgin, Shop Girl, Dark Water, Brick, Mission Impossible 3, The Breakup, and Serenity. And I'm not going to get into why particularly any of those, but because I've discussed them probably on past episodes of Film Spotting. But I have to thank, I mean, it's one of the best things about doing Film Spotting, and I thought of it most recently, honestly, with The Breakup. It's like, you know what, I never would have seen this movie if not, and it's really a surprise and definitely worth seeing.
Yeah, The Breakup almost made my list, and when you said you were going that way, Sam, I did the same thing, and I've got in my 6 through 10, if you will, two movies from our horror marathon, Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Reanimator.
Point.
Two films I never really wanted to see and thought I would hate, and I ended up liking both of them. Also, another kind of horror film, if you will, I have actually got two of them. I had Dark Water and also Red Eye, the Wes Craven film.
Oh, yeah.
I thought was really a lot of fun. I also have Personal Velocity. We watched this movie in conjunction with The Ballad of Jack and Rose. We talked about it recently on our top five chick flicks, and it is a chick flick, and maybe because of that, it was a movie I never thought I wanted to see.
Yeah.
And also, of course, I have to throw on The Lake House. We're not talking about it anymore. The Lake House is on there.
You brought it up. You opened it in Pandora's box.
What is your number five, Sam?
All right, my number five, strange, because it directed by a favorite filmmaker of mine, starring one of my favorite actors. It's Master and Commander, Far Side of the World. It wasn't that I thought I'd hate it because of the people involved. It was that nautical movies do not interest me at all. I was like, oh my God, what a great pairing. Peter Weir and Russell Crowe. God, I wish they had paired up on something
else.
And Paul Bettany, yeah. And the fact is, I absolutely loved this film. And I had another beef with actually Patrick O'Brien. He wrote the two novels that this film is based on. His books, really, and there are like 30 or 1,000 of them, really, and they're all right next to Michael Ondaatje's books in the bookstore, my favorite author. And I was always like, you know, they either wouldn't have a Michael Ondaatje book and have like 30 Patrick O'Brien books with these really lame drawings of ships on the cover. And I was like, who is this guy? I don't care. So I had a kind of personal beef. But the fact is, this movie really is fantastic. I own it. I've seen it a couple times. And it's great. It's a great movie that captures, you know, men being men and on the high seas and battles of loyalty. And the fact that it makes you appreciate and understand something as confounding as seafaring strategy really is enough to give it the credit.
No, I'm with you. I thought I would like it, but I liked it a lot more than I thought I would. And if we had gone ahead with our top five nautical movies, may have been number one for both of us.
Yeah,
my number five is a movie that was actually an overlooked DVD pick of mine a while back. And I told you, Sam, one of the strategies I used for this top five was just to think of directors I hate and see if they made one movie I actually didn't mind.
Right.
And that would be Joel Schumacher's film Tigerland.
Oh,
this is a movie set in Basic Training, 1971, Louisiana. You've got Colin Farrell in it, and it's really his first role, his first Hollywood role as an R.P. McMurphy-type character like Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, who won't conform to the Army. And leading up to this movie, I'm just going to mention the eight films that Joel Schumacher had made before Tigerland. Falling Down, The Client, Batman Forever, A Time to Kill, Batman and Robin, 8mm and Flawless. Well, you know what? Despite Philip Seymour Hoffman, I've never seen Flawless, but the other seven are all sort of bad to really awful. And so here he kind of went independent filmmaker, went low budget. I actually think Tigerland is a decent movie worth seeing. So it was a shocker for me.
Good pick. In your 6 through 10, you mentioned Personal Velocity. It's my number 4. And I hate admitting this, really, because it sort of reveals a bias of mine. But I had just seen recently, just before I saw Personal Velocity, seen Lovely and Amazing and also 13 Conversations About One Thing, both written and directed by women. And I have to say, I approached Personal Velocity thinking I would have a similar experience. I didn't like either of those films, and it's a completely unfair set of criteria to be approaching a film, as they are all different people. And I was really surprised by it. I mean, it's just, and I feel like I've talked about it three or four times on Film Spotting, but the film is filled with fantastic performances and really subtle, nuanced writing and acting. It's a great film.
My number four is The Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, and I'm not going to go into any detail because we discussed it during our review in the first segment. I explained why I like that movie, and it was, I actually am kind of calling this list the Princess Bride Memorial List because, yeah, as I've explained on the show before, I had that experience that the kid has in the movie, I'm drawing a blank, the Wonder Years, what's his name, Fred Savage that he has in the movie where he doesn't want to hear this story that his grandfather's going to tell him, then he ends up loving it.
The kissing stuff.
We watched this movie in eighth grade. In junior high, I was like, why are we watching a movie called The Princess Bride? And I ended up loving it, of course. And this movie, to me, kind of felt like a modern version of that or a new take on The Princess Bride. And that's why it's my number four. I really, as I said, was not interested in even seeing it. I waited forever after it came out on DVD, and I liked it a lot. So,
all right. Well, my number three is, I think, an overlooked DVD pick of mine a while ago, and it is Down with Love, directed by Peyton Reed, of course, the director of The Breakup. I think it was, I just didn't have any interest in seeing this movie. You know, I just figured it would be a very precious, winking, tongue-in-cheek kind of sending up, mocking of these, you know, this pillow talk kind of movies with Rock Hudson, Doris Day. And I didn't have any stake in that genre. I didn't see why it needed to be updated, and I didn't want to really go through the process of them winking and nodding at a genre I didn't understand or care about. Turns out they have a lot of sincere affection for that genre, and they made me appreciate what it is. I mean, in terms of a comic genre. And I love the genuineness of it, and the performances are fantastic. Ewan McGregor and Renee Zellweger are both really good. The supporting cast is great, and it's a film definitely worth tracking down.
Okay, my number three is a tie, two Tony Scott movies, Spy Game and Man on Fire. And of course, Tony Scott is the guy who made True Romance, and he made will always be one of my
favorite films, Top Gun.
But let's face it, he's made Beverly Hills Cop 2, Days of Thunder, The Last Boy Scout. These are movies that are guilty pleasures at best. The Fan is terrible. And he makes these big, high-octane action movies that really a film snob like me is not supposed to enjoy. But you know what? What I loved about Spy Game was the little details, the interactions between characters and their relationships. Robert Redford's One Step Ahead of You charisma, I thought it was a really interesting kind of fun film with Brad Pitt, where Brad Pitt's actually not that annoying in it. And also then Man on Fire with Denzel Washington. It's a revenge movie. You have to have a bloodlust to enjoy this film. And it's got kind of a cheesy surprise, if you will, ending. And despite all that, you know what? I guess I wanted the blood because I was somehow into it. And I was actually even moved by the ending, even as I knew that I should know better, that I shouldn't be enjoying this. I liked both of them. So
Tony Scott will forever be forgiven for anything else he does for True Romance.
True Romance.
All right. My number two was in our Westerns Marathon. It was actually the third film we saw in the Westerns Marathon. We went out of chronological order, unlike the rest of the marathons we've done. You know, we started with High Noon, which I didn't think was all that great, which I know is sacrilege, and then we went out of order again with The Searchers, another film.
I didn't think was all that great, and I should be shot.
The racist depictions of Native Americans and the hammy wooden acting, all that stuff. Anyway, so we set up to watch the third film in the marathon, Stagecoach, directed by John Ford, and I was like, this is going to be an endless marathon of me hating on films that are classics. Turns out Stagecoach I absolutely loved. And it was really the excitement of genre of the Western really was born with that film. And I can't give enough credit to it and really just how much fun this is. I don't know how eager people are to go and just throw Stagecoach in their queue, but it's really a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it just came out on DVD in a special collection,
edition.
John Ford collection. You should check it out. My number two, Sam, is a movie directed by Amy Heckerling that I don't know that has ever fit in to Film Spotting at all, but it is the movie Clueless. Huh. And I have to say, before I looked at her IMDb filmography, I had no idea she directed one of my all-time favorite nostalgia...
Fast Times?
Yes, of course.
Oh.
I knew she directed
okay.
that. No, don't jump ahead of me here, Sam. Come on. That she directed Johnny Dangerously, one of my all-time favorite movies from my youth, Johnny Dangerously.
Wow.
Before Clueless, she had made the two Look Who's Talking movies, okay? But here with
classics
Clueless,
of the genre,
I really
of the talking baby genre.
Exactly. But here, you know, this is another chick flick, which as guys, we sometimes, why do I want to go see that movie? But I think she captured the zeitgeist of the 90s a lot like she did in the 80s with Fast Times. And I think it's a really smart screenplay. Those great words and phrases that had been added to the lexicon either because of the film or it was just tapping into, you know, something that we weren't getting here in the Midwest and it was made mainstream. So I did really actually like Clueless quite a bit. I recommend it to people.
It's a nice pick. All right. Well, my number one is the first film I thought of. I was coming back from a Cincinnati Reds game with some friends back to college up in Gambier, Ohio. And we had some time to kill, so we pulled into a movie theater in Columbus, Ohio on opening weekend of The Matrix. And all I had, my only impression of it really was like, well, this film stars Keanu Reeves. It's a mindless sci-fi action film. I think he had made a similar looking, I can't remember the name of the film. He'd made a really—
I know, but you're right.
Yeah, he'd made a kind of like paranoid sci-fi action film not too long before The Matrix came out, and it was, you know, reviled and bombed. And I think it's just, The Matrix just happened to be playing at that time, and I was completely and utterly blown away by it. No expectations. I don't think I'd read any reviews of it even, even to say that it was really a surprising, smart, thoughtful film. I have to say, it's just like, I think it's a total classic. And the fact that, and to see it under those circumstances was really perfect, to be surprised by something like that.
Well, I guess I can only say that you actually stole my number one, except that you didn't, because I forgot
it. You forgot The Matrix.
But you're right. I actually remember, Sam, I was living in Chicago at the time. It was before I moved back here about 5 years ago. And I took one of those online, you know, I got an email about, would you participate in this movie survey? And they showed you clips from a movie, and they want you to rate, this movie's going to come out 6 months from now or whatever. And would you rate how likely you are to see it? And it was The Matrix.
Wow.
And I saw who the star was, Keanu Reeves. I saw that, you know, this sci-fi movie, just like you said, and I just looked at it and said, there's no way I'm going to see this movie. There's
not what's the likelihood? Not a chance.
Yeah. I said, I have no desire to see The Matrix. And, you know, I was in film school at the time. I was being this film snob.
Right.
No desire to see it. I ended up seeing it and loving it.
Yeah.
So you're right. It should be my number one, but my actual number one is...
When you're a jet, you're a top cat in town. You're a gold medal kid with a heavyweight crown. When you're a jet, you're the swinging a thing. Little boy, you're a man. Little man, you're a king. The Jets are in gear.
Oh, I just can't get enough of the sharks and the jets, Sam. It has to
wow.
be West Side Story.
Really?
I avoided this movie. As you know, it was the film in the musicals
true.
Marathon that you had seen, the one film you had seen that I hadn't seen. And it's a musical. I always thought musicals were kind of cheesy. It's 152 minutes long.
Yeah.
And I had seen enough parts of it to see Russ Tamblyn, all 5'6" of him, whatever, you know, who I do love from Twin Peaks, I'd say, but Russ Tamblyn looking really lame, trying to look tough while singing
in
and dancing.
Did he have the red jacket?
I think it was the red jacket. Riff. It just looked like, oh my God, a musical that's 2.5 hours long.
I'm not going to do it.
And guys looking really stupid.
You're ready to chuck it up in terms of films I'm not even embarrassed about. I'm never going to see
them. No, you're right. It also became one of those movies that I think will be an eventual top five where it's like movies at this point I don't even care if I ever see because everyone else loves them so much and I'm just going to be like hard and fast and stubborn
Forget
and not watch it.
It.
I was that way with West Side Story. Of course, what happens? We review it, my favorite film of the musicals marathon. Also, Spike Lee's most watched movie. I mentioned that Slate article.
Interesting.
A while on our last week's show, I think. The article about what movie have you seen the most in your life? Spike Lee's was West Side Story.
That is our top five. Please send your top five or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message.
Opening in wide release this weekend, Owen Wilson, Matt Dillon, and Kate Hudson in You, Me, and Dupree. Little Man from the Wayans Brothers and Richard Linklater's adaptation of Philip K. Dick's A Scanner Darkly. Next week, we'll review A Scanner Darkly and share our top five movies about drugs and addiction. Thanks to Alejandro Escovedo and Bloodshot Records for today's music. Please check him out on the web at bloodshotrecords.com.
Check out our Top 5 Archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. Also on the blog, sign up for the Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast. Last week on the Dope Sheet, I shared some thoughts on Friends with Money, and Adam gave you his overlooked DVD pick of the week. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Holger.
I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Swap the DVDs you have for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
Pronunciation to try?
Anime.
Anime.
Yeah.
Anime at 63%, coming in behind animation. John Cassavetes.
Animation. we're worthless.